Morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, January 28th. We have an informational meeting today, only an informational meeting, on property tax. Mr. Allenek.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So we are continuing with the overview slash orientation, and this morning's topic is property tax, and Jamie McGovern is the economist in the office who is handling property tax these days. So she's going to provide information this morning that should be informative and fill in some gaps about how the property tax system is structured, how the tax calculation works, along with some basic statistics.
Hello.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jamie. Can you guys hear me? I'm Jamie McGovern from Legislative Revenue. Again, with the caveat from last week that I know that some of you have seen some of this before, and the property tax system presentation here gets a little in-depth and sometimes circular because the definitions relate to each other. Feel free to ask questions, and I'll try to move along at your pace. Okay, so I'm going to start out with just a little bit of framework that I think everybody knows that in Oregon, our property tax system revolves around and is based on Measure 5 and Measure 50. But before Measure 5, 1990, we had the lion's share of school funding coming from property taxes. And in sort of current days, we have state equalization formula, and that addressed some of the inequities that we saw before Measure 5. And we didn't have the $5 and $10 limits on the property taxes that we do now. And so when the $5 and $10 limits came along, they came along on top of real market value with Measure 5, because that's all that we had in that sort of time frame. And just to give a perspective on how complex that was, there was 232 pages for Measure 5.
And we before came, you leave that slide, you mentioned in your explanation that the concept of addressing inequities pre-Measure 5. Say a little bit more about what sort of inequities existed that could be addressed then.
So, thank you, Chair. My comment was in reference to the idea that school dollars were funded locally in large part through property taxes. And when Measure 5 came along and the school equalization formula came along, and I will say as an aside that in our office, Dave Beck, he works with the school funding and school finance, so he would be able to comment a little bit more on how the that formula works. But in order to make sure that all students are getting funded similarly, the state brings in money that some counties don't provide in their property taxes currently. And some people have mentioned that changes in our property tax system, while they wouldn't bring money to the general fund at the state level, might relieve some burden from that because some of the state dollars flow into different counties that don't provide as much funding through their local taxes. Okay, and so before we got to Measure 50, we had a levy-based system, and I will talk a little bit more about that down the road, but this idea that these districts would calculate their budgets, and when that budget was set, then they would apportion that out to the property holders in their district. And so that means that the taxes that were assigned to the different property owners would depend on how large the budget was for the taxing district. And that's different than how it works today. In that time, the taxing district would get the full amount. In the case of a levy, because you're sort of sharing a pie of responsibility, if your property value increased by more than your neighbors as a proportion, you may end up paying more, even if the sort of size of the pie or the budget requirements didn't increase. I'll talk in these slides a little bit about how it works now versus a levy system. And that was also a very complicated and a lengthy bill. So in 1990, when Measure 5 was passed, we set a $5 cap on school taxes per 1,000, and we set a $10 cap on non-school or general government per $1,000. So that, again, was in real market value, because that was what we had at the time, and that was how property was assessed. And then you can see, and this responds a little bit to some comments from a couple months ago, that starting with Measure 50, we now have this definition or this distinction between what is the real market value and the value that's used for taxation, which is called the assessed value. And so now we have two different growth rates, and you can see that the sort of assessed value ticks up kind of steadily, whereas the real market value responds to recessions and expansion. And later in the presentation, I'll also talk about how the difference or the gap in some of those and the changes between assessed value and real market value have affected individual property owners. Okay, into a little bit. One last thing. With the passage of Measure 50, we now have what we think of as the CPR, or the changed property ratio. And I'm going to talk about that in a couple slides, but it's very close to the relationship between the assessed value and the real market value. And so that didn't exist before, because there wasn't this distinction. In particular, it's the maximum assessed value, but in many cases, the maximum assessed value and the assessed value are the same. So now we have this changed property ratio that tells us how our local government is valuing our property for the purpose of taxes in relation to how the market values our property. And so you could imagine you feel sort of lucky if your house is worth a lot, but the assessed value is really low, because you're getting taxed on that low value, and therefore you would experience lower taxes than if your assessed value was higher. And so a low CPR or a low changed property ratio, you might feel lucky if you had one, but it would mean that you would have lower taxes than you would otherwise. Evidently, my clicks are going backwards. Measure 5, we also created what's called a permanent rate. And so in the passage of Measure 5, or Measure 50, we have this rate that we now put on taxing districts, and we say that they are authorized to charge a level of taxes or give them taxing authority permanently for their taxing district. I will point out that taxing districts have also passed things like local options and bonds on top of that permanent rate to raise more money. But the Measure 50 set a permanent rate at the time, and that stays fixed. And the way that changes in terms of dollars is that as your property value increases and you apply that consistent rate towards it, the taxing district continues to raise more money year after year.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the $200 million, or $200 billion reflected in on this table on Exhibit 6? Is that an accurate number on the difference between real market value and assessed value? And is that, can you break that down between personal and business and industry property taxes? Did I read that correctly?
And Representative Finley, you're asking me whether the difference between the assessed value and real market value as represented on the graph is approximately accurate? Yes.
And can you break that between personal and
the residential, right?
Residential rather, and commercial and industrial?
Yes, I can. So we have we have some data broken out by property class, and I can get those in more detail.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And while you're still on that slide, does CPR mean we really need to fix this? Is this system in need of CPR? I just, it's a little joke at the expense of the acronym on the slide.
Yeah, actually, that's a problem. In looking up information for other states, when you type in CPR, local property districts or taxing districts, you end up getting emergency measures. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Okay, a little bit of vocabulary. I'll run through it relatively quickly unless you have questions, but we have something that we call the Measure 5 value, and that is what is allowed statutorily as the assessed value. And as I mentioned before, the assessed value is what people care about because their taxes are assessed on their assessed value. Different properties, like forest properties, nonprofits, they might have specially assessed valuations. And so they will have an assessed value, but in being taxed, the tax will be taxed upon the specially assessed value.
It's not a system of different rates. It's the same rate applied to different assessment methodology. Is that correct?
Chair Nathanson, that's accurate. And I will say, in looking at the property tax systems in different states, that approach does vary. So and I'll show this in future slides, but if you're located in a specific set of taxing districts, you pay a specific rate. The difference comes in how your property is valued. In other states, sometimes they will have similar or different values as we do in the assessment, but also different property classes have different rates assigned to them. So there's different ways that you can sort of toggle that. So real market value, just the idea that nobody would be forced into a transaction. And so in a voluntary transaction, what your property could reasonably be expected to garner in a sort of informed market. I think that is kind of common. And so our maximum assessed value is, I point out, I think myself actually included, but people outside this building often think that your assessed value is some relationship, like a proportion of your real market value. But the way that it is set up in Oregon is formulaic, and if your property was existing in 1997, Essentially, what happened is they took the value of the property in 1997, they moved it back 1 year to 1995-96 values, and then discounted that by 10%, so that was 90% of the previous year's value. And then it is incremented every year by no more than 3%. And so it's a formulaic approach from the 1995-96 property value. The reason I think that, as Chair Nathanson mentioned, that people care about the CPR, the change property ratio, is when property comes on the roll, as it's called, or it's new, that, or like a new construction, or for instance, if people have done major modifications to their property, then that property comes on to the roll, or it's being taxed at the real market value multiplied by what's called the change property ratio. And that change property ratio is the ratio of assessed values, maximum assessed values, to real market values all over what was historically the county, and they take the average of that. So if the average around the county is 0.65, they would, a new house is built and it was $100,000, which would be amazing, I'm sure, then it would end up being 0.65 times the 100,000, and the new assessed value would come on at 65,000. So the approach is formulaic. It's not a relationship specifically to the current real market value.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be possible to get what you just said written down, or a couple of examples like that, just written down, take a property worth $100,000 to keep it simple for a member on the committee? And that'd be great. So give me a $100,000 home built in 1991, one built in 2001, and maybe, yeah, that'd be great. That'd be helpful, just so I can run through what she said and visualize it with real numbers and see the difference.
We'll all appreciate it. Thank you for asking.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rep. Reschke. Chair Nathanson, I will, I'll work up some examples for you. I also have a couple slides that are the courtesy of League of Oregon Cities. They've looked into some data, and I'll provide information in different locales. And as you can imagine, if you have a house in 1991 that came on the roll and it was $100,000, depending on how that area prospered, is going to affect what the value is for assessment purposes of your property today, versus if it was located somewhere else.
Right. Marion County isn't going to look the same as Coos County.
Exactly.
Or Wheeler.
Exactly.
Right, because I built a home in 1994 in Bethany, and within 7 years it grew 1,400% the area, and so it changed from this rural area West Union to this big metropolitan. Then I built a house in rural Oregon in 2001, and it hasn't grown at all population-wise or economic-wise. It's the same that I built 20 years ago. So it'd be interesting just kind of see, like you said, some real examples how this plays out. And I'm done building homes, so that's
okay. I will also comment so we have the maximum assessed value escalating at 3% per year, no matter when your house or property came on the roll. And then now we have the assessed value. So I'm going to show in the next slide how that relates to the maximum assessed value and your real market value. I'll point out that the CPR is this countywide average of those two numbers. And then I think it was HB 2088, so we had a couple of years ago. That is a little bit different now because there are some places like Gresham which are able to calculate their CPR for purposes of bringing properties onto the roll at a local level, and so they don't have to look to the countywide CPR, partly for a reason that is similar to what Rick Rischke mentioned.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, one of the things I think is important to point out for this committee is that real market value is not the same as appraised value. And quite often, especially in rural Oregon, and I'm assuming in urban Oregon, your real market value tends to be significantly less than the appraised value. One of the issues at some time the legislature ought to take a look at is there a way to true those up a little bit more? If I'm correct on this, and I think I am, that appraisals or assessments, excuse me, of real estate have to be completed at least once every 10 years. And so quite often those assessments aren't keeping up with what the market's really doing. And so I just think that's important for us to realize.
Thank you. Okay. So, okay, so I just wanted to point out that on this chart, this is a particular property, and you can see that the real market value during periods of recession dipped below what was called the maximum assessed value, which we had just talked about. And so what happens is people don't like to get taxed on more than their property is worth, I assume. And so the way that Oregon approaches the taxable assessed value is that your house would sort of, the maximum assessed value being the blue line, we can think that, oh, our house is often taxed along that blue line. But at the point in time where we have a recession and that the value of your property dips below what is that tracking maximum assessed value, which is that formulaic approach, then the value on which you are getting taxed would follow the lower line. So it would follow the real market value during that period. And so from 2009-ish to 2013-14, this property was being taxed on the real market value, the red line. And then once the red line or the real market value appreciates enough that it starts to recover and moves past that formulaic maximum assessed value, the property will be taxed along the maximum assessed value again. So the taxable assessed value is tracking the lower of those two lines. And for that, that is why sometimes, although the maximum assessed value, that blue line, cannot increase by more than 3% per year, if you're in one particular year below the blue line or the maximum assessed value and then your property recovers, you may see a change in the value for taxation that's more than 3% when you recover.
When you say it can't exceed 3%, does it generally hit 3% exactly, or sometimes is it less?
The growth is 3%.
Yes. Yeah.
It's never 2.9.
Yeah.
Okay. So taxing districts, it's always possible to create a new taxing district. In fact, I think there might be a bill up for a taxing to create a children's service taxing district this session. But there are many different taxing districts, and there's some that are really common. And when I give examples later on, I'm just going to sort of condense my examples down into like three or four taxing. And so you can think that all of these taxing districts have statutory authority to impose taxes. And most people that live in a city will live in a confluence of these different taxing districts. So you will live in a county, but also in a city, and be a part of a school district, possibly library, and a fire district. And so you will be subject to all those sort of layer cake of taxes. And when you get your tax bill, you will see a final number. But this will be the sum of all those different taxes that are imposed on you from those taxing districts. And if you are, you're paying taxes, you're paying at the permanent rate for each of those districts, and that's expressed in Oregon. In other places, they express it differently, but in Oregon, we express this in terms of dollars per 1,000, and that's the $5, $10 per 1,000 that we talked about also in Measure 5.
I'm very used to hearing dollars per 1,000. What are other options for expressing that?
In some places, they express them as a percent or a tare rate. So dollars per 1,000 is different than percent, which is per $100 of value, something like that.
Question? Yes. Thank you, Chair. And to be clear, there is a permanent taxing rate, but it doesn't have to be imposed at its maximum.
Correct. And I'm going to talk also about the boundaries on those rates and how they add up.
I assume compression will come up at that point in time.
It might come up.
Part of our vocabulary here.
Have you experienced this?
Yes, I have.
And I do apologize in putting these slides together. So many of these definitions and relationships depend on each other. So some of the things I'll get to when I would have liked to get to them earlier. Okay. So I think in pictures, and I was trying to express what your property might experience. It's, as I pointed out, there you could be in 12 taxing districts, but so I put a few of those on here. And so, you know, in my mind, you have this yellow county. And inside that county might lie the city, which is the green area. And then you may have two different school districts within that city. You might have a city like Salem and have a large school district, or like Eugene and have a large school district. But they may have other places may have school districts that are two different school districts or three different school districts distinct in the city, especially if you account for community colleges. You may have fire districts or safety districts that overlap two different school districts. So, for instance, if I lived in the greenhouse, I'm going to be in the same fire district as maybe somebody that was over in the blue, but I'm in a different school district. And so mathematicians call this a Venn diagram, or something similar to a Venn diagram, these sort of intersection or overlapping of different areas or layers. And so, and we get to the point that we have layered on all the different taxing districts that our individual property is subject to. That's what we call a code area. And so those are unique. So you can have a neighborhood that's in a code area, and then maybe some property or a house that's very close to it, and they're in a different code area. Maybe they go to the same school district, but they have a different fire district. And so that would put you separate in the sense that you'd also be being taxed at a separate rate or a different rate for that fire district. And then you can see you might have like an industrial plant or a business, and it's not actually in a school district at all. So some properties may be outside of a school district because they're in a very rural area, not inside a city. So you might have some properties that aren't in districts that other properties are in, not just in different districts. And it might be a little more complicated. I just want to point out, when you have some of these things and they're split by counties. So for instance, when we look at Salem, we're split by Marion County and Polk County. And so then you might have some of these taxing districts that spread across different counties. And normally we would, normally they occur in the same county, and that's kind of how we think of them. But it just becomes slightly more complicated in terms of the data when they are over split counties. Okay.
We have how many special districts in Oregon?
That I can get for you.
A bunch.
Five. Yeah.
A lot. More than two.
One time I actually created a list of all the types of special districts there are. Dozens of types, and of course many special districts within each type. If I can put my hands on that easily, I'll share it with the committee. It's quite impressive.
Okay, more on the cakes. So if you think of your property sitting in a bunch of different taxing districts, they sit in sort of this layer cake of taxing districts, and each of those taxing districts have the authority to impose taxes. And the way that I was trying to think of how we deal with our property tax system now than before the reform is the idea that a levy versus a rate-based system. And so in a levy system, those budgets that are decided, we think of that as like the size of the pie or the size of the cake. And that is a particular dollar amount that's needed to run the schools or the government. And so they would set up that budget and then apportion that to the individual property owners. So those individual dollar amounts are decided, and for the different taxing districts stacked upon each other. I don't know how I did that. And then for an individual, what we care about are our own property taxes. And so you can think of your own property taxes as like a slice of those layers. In our current property tax system, it isn't this size of the or this large pie or cake, the size of that that's being decided, and then you get a fixed slice of that. What happens now is your property is valued, and then the rate is put upon that. And you can think of adding all those slices together to form this probably absurd looking cake, but to form the total amount of revenue that's collected. So the levy system sort of works in one direction, which is the dollar amounts are decided in total and then apportioned to the individual property owners. In our current system, we have a particular rate that's set upon those individual properties at those different layers, and those are added together to go towards the local government. Okay. And in Oregon, the school is separate from all non-school government functions. And so in that sense, we have the $10 cap and the $5 cap that's set per 1,000. But those caps are specifically set on real market value. So you can imagine the case where you have very low assessed value compared to a very high real market value, which is what happens when the economy expands, your property value takes off, and the assessed value is still tracking at 3%. And in that case, those $5 per 1,000 and $10 per 1,000 caps don't have as much impact on what we call compression, because the assessed values aren't high enough to sort of trigger that when applied with the rates. Okay.
Can you go back?
Yes.
And once compression does hit, how do you prioritize which of the local government loses those resources out of that, not the $5, but the $10?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Hernandez. In just like two slides, I think you've anticipated what I'm about to talk about.
Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. So we just talked about this, so I'm going to say that when I was looking up some stuff, I decided to look up examples of bills and thought that this was not going to help us at all because I got really confused. But this is what Marion County gives, and in terms of explaining a particular bill. I think that's helpful if you wanted to know your particular bill and those layers that are in there for all the different types of taxes, but it's not helpful in just figuring out how the taxes are assessed from a macro level, which I think is the question that Representative Hernandez has. Okay. So if we think of our two buckets, the school and non-school, so to speak, and each district has taxing authority. We have the permanent rate, which is set statutorily. Then you can think that individuals vote in often local options and bonds. And the local options and the bonds act slightly differently. The bonds are levies, and often the local options are voted in and as a rate. And so the levy is a fixed amount of dollars that the bond, they may want to build a new police station or something like this, and so they figure out what the amount of money is. And that will come to you in your property bill in terms of a rate, but it is set at as a sort of levy. So we still do have levies in our system, but that's not part of the permanent rate that was set statutorily back in the 90s. And then we're going to talk a little bit in a few slides. I just want to mention that urban renewal is a part of the non-school portion. And so we have also urban renewal, which is a value part of our taxing system, but it operates differently than everything else. So we'll set it aside for a minute, but it's a portion of the non-school. Also in schools, we have sort of different taxes. We have a permanent rate, local options, and bonds. Okay, so in terms of compression, if we think of our $10 and $5 limits, it's sort of the cap that you can get up to. And so I've got two examples, but I'm happy to answer questions. We have two words that become important here. One is extended and one is imposed. And so extended, whenever we have a taxing rate, it is the rate that theoretically the taxing authority would like you to pay, but it may pass that threshold of $10 or $5, and so it may be compressed. And so it gets added into the calculation. The permanent rate gets priority, and so we start with the permanent rate, and then the voters might have voted in some local options. Now, if the local option goes beyond the $10 in the non-government or non-school taxing authority, then what we'll do is say that we have to compress that total value down to $10, but the local options go first. They don't have priority over the permanent rate. And so once we compress those down to meet the $10 threshold, those amounts are what we call, those are the taxes that are imposed. Something that's slightly different Bonds are not subject to this. Bonds, when they get passed, they can be in excess of the $5 or $10 threshold.
Yes, thank you. And can I just, while you're saying it, is that because bonds work like levies and that they're a dollar amount divided by the properties as opposed to being a percentage? Is that why they can go past the cap?
I don't know, Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith-Warner, I don't know what the intent was, but I could definitely imagine a very functional problem when you set out to build a new police station and you sign contracts for that, and then the values of the property in your locale change so that you can't pay those bills. Chris might have more to say on that.
I think the core reason is that they're debt.
Yeah.
Mm. The bonds represent debt that the governments owe.
So that can be. Voters approved.
That the voters approved.
So that's why they're not.
They're not compressed because they're
debt. Override. Okay. Common, some of them is called override levies.
Okay.
Override levies. Mm.
Thank you.
And then, slightly different example. You may have a permanent rate that you start with and you're below the $5, for example, in school. And you have a local option that's extended. And both of these are extended because we're waiting to see if they hit the threshold of the $5, and then just as we talked about, and then you have a bond, but that goes beyond the $5, but it's not compressed, and therefore all the rates that were extended now become imposed because you didn't hit the cap. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have an idea of the number of districts that are in compression?
Represent Finley and Chair Nathanson. I don't have it in this presentation, but I did some of that work over the summer. And I also, the Department of Revenue publishes some statistics on that. And I can say that, it has decreased as the economy has improved, but there still are areas in compression.
I think it would probably matter on how the economy has improved. I know that in Eastern Oregon, the rate of compression is much higher than perhaps in Western Oregon.
Yes, Representative Finley, and I've also seen that some areas, the compression has increased. Mm-hmm. So I can get that for you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't know how to ask this, but there's the equalizer of the state school fund for the education component.
Mm-hmm.
And so if a school district has a higher rate, it'll balance itself out eventually with the general fund. So I'm trying to figure out, is for local school districts, in terms of the permanent rate, is there an incentive to not increase a rate because if they get more money from property taxes, it'll balance itself out in terms of state school fund? Does that make sense?
Representative Hernandez, Chair Nathanson, I can say that the schools are not allowed to change their permanent rate. I know that there are.
Excuse me. Before we get too much into that, we're going to have a special discussion for almost an entire meeting on this topic. Okay. Maybe we should let you off the hook for this morning.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on. Thank you. So we have some examples of what happens in compression, and rates that are not in compression that are extended will be imposed. Okay. So I know that this committee has been faced with property tax issues in the past. And so one of the key implications of Measure 5 and Measure 50, stepping back a little, is that almost all changes to the property tax must go to the voters because they are Measure 5 and Measure 50, the fundamental sort of basis of our property tax system in the Constitution. And as I mentioned, the CPR is instrumental in how much money a local district can raise. So not just so the issue with Gresham, for instance, in wanting to change their the CPR calculation from countywide, which included Portland, and so the sort of net CPR, including Gresham, was in the 0.6s and wasn't helping them raise revenue, has a short-term impact because individual properties that come on to the roller built in Gresham will now be multiplied by this higher CPR that exists locally for that city. So an individual property that was, say, 100,000, instead of being multiplied by 0.65, it will be multiplied by 0.79, and so that their assessed value in the current year will be higher, and they'll be able to tax on that higher value. But then, sort of cumulatively, it has a long-term effect, which is the average CPR for that locality will be higher because they don't have to include high-growth areas like Portland. So there's this short-term and long-term effect. And Gresham estimated last year that there was an increase in revenue of $60,000, just to give an idea of what they believe that the impact was of
2088.
$60,000
for a year, 1 year?
For that year. Okay. So this is provided by the League of Oregon Cities. These individual examples of two different properties that in 1997 we have some data and what happened in 2013. So. What's happening here is you have both of the houses in 2013 selling for approximately $325,000. So that tells you that they have a similar real market value in recent history. But the difference in property taxes is very large. And the way that that can happen is several different ways, but in Portland, what they've seen is that property values in areas like Southeast and Southwest, where they've taken off, the real market value has skyrocketed, the assessed value has stayed relatively flat, and so I'll show in some later slides the ratio of assessed value to real market value. Some of those are 0.2, 0.3, and others are around 0.9. So there's this big difference. I could tell you the exact story if those two neighborhoods. Yeah. I will also mention that the second example of these two houses is in Salem. And in looking at the data between Multnomah County and Marion County, I found that this dispersion of this assessment rate to real market value looks almost identical now in Marion County as it did to Multnomah County 5 years ago. And so sort of Marion County is situated where Multnomah County was from the CPR issue perspective in the same place that they were 5 years ago. So this tale of two houses is, I think, kind of highlights what people talk about as what we think of as the neighbor-to-neighbor inequities. Okay.
Yes. Thank you. Do we have those kinds of examples for other more rural parts of the state?
Representative Marsh, Chair Nathanson, I don't have specific properties that I have looked up, which can definitely be done. A lot of assessor web pages have public data, and so I can work on that. I have the data for all the counties looking at all of the dispersion in the properties, their CPRs, their assessed values, but I don't have any particular addresses, but I do have the value, assessed value and real market value for all those properties, and I have them charted out. I think I give two counties here, but I have them charted out back in my office for each of the counties to kind of look at what each of those counties are sort of struggling with or dealing with, and I'm happy to give more of that on an informational session or individually.
Yes. The reason I ask is because any kind of property tax reforms that we look at down the way depend on voter approval, and when we have areas of the state that don't have such diverse neighborhoods, mm-hmm. we may not see, I'm curious as to whether you see those inequities, mm-hmm. all of which sort of translates back into how voters would view an effort to change the property tax that, and how we are communicating what those inequities are among communities.
So the next slide that I have gives all the counties that I have data for in a snapshot, and I'll discuss that. And then I do have another presentation that I worked on for inequities that has the actual individual properties for each county all plotted out. So those can be depicted more strongly. So This graph or chart is a representation of the different counties, and the sort of horizontal lines is the CPR, that ratio of assessed value to the real market value. And so the little diamond there falls on the median of those individual counties. So you can see that, for instance, Multnomah County has a very low CPR, and other counties have a very high CPR. I want to talk about that in a minute in terms of what that means. But you also might notice that a county like Multnomah has a very wide box, a long vertical box. What that means is there's a lot of difference or variance or dispersion within that county. So the boxes that are very tight or small means that regardless of what the median CPR is in that county, all the properties are really similar, close together, relatively speaking. So that their CPRs would all be kind of similar in a place like, for instance, Jackson, or Polk County. So relative to some place like Multnomah, which is County 26, if you look at Polk County, which is County 27, then there's not only a higher CPR, which is an average, but the counties or the properties in Polk are more similar to each other in terms of their assessed value to their real market value.
So this follows directly behind the slide you just showed us, which is for Multnomah County. The difference in taxes paid for those two homes was over $3,400.
Correct.
It relates directly to the illustration on the previous slide.
Yes, Chair Nathanson. So one of those properties might be sort of at the lower end of that box, and one might be at the higher end of that box. I wanted to mention what it means for some of these, and I think I have a couple more slides in this area, but what it means for a property to have a CPR of one, unless it's an industrial or commercial property, which has depreciation involved. What that often means is the property is still, if you remember that chart where I said that the assessed value was the lower of those two lines, so that means that the real market value is below the maximum assessed value, and it's being taxed at its full value, which means it hasn't recovered possibly from a recession. So it's not necessarily better to be at a CPR of one, because that may mean that properties are struggling to recover from a recession. If a property is very low in terms of the CPR, say 0.2 or 0.3, that can also mean that it's not, it does mean that it's not being assessed near its real market value.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would have two observations on this, and I just want to see if you could confirm or deny them. The first is, looking at what the three counties are that are closest to one, those are all rural counties. It's Baker, Malheur, Harney, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I would read that as meaning, because those are places where there haven't been big spikes in property value, and therefore that whole 3% a year has pretty much tracked with what their real market value has been, or real market is below that. So that's, and you are nodding to confirm that for those of you who are just listening. And number two, the other thing I would see in this is that there's a lot of conversations about reset at sale for whether, you know, a way to change our property tax system. So my read on this is that the further down, the lower your, and this is the CPV, the ratio is the CPV, or no. The lower you are on the smaller your number on this, the bigger impact there would be on for reset at sale. Because I would argue that, Harney, or not Harney, Malheur, mm-hmm. up there almost entire, you know, closest to one and the smallest, mm-hmm. reset at sale wouldn't make that big of a difference because they're paying either similar about that amount anyway. Whereas Multnomah, I would argue, would have a very big impact because you've got everybody is, you know, at best, you're significantly below the change there. And then 14, like, and Hood River, yeah, that doesn't surprise me that Hood River County is another one like that. So, okay, so you would agree with that. So that is where the biggest impact would be for reset at sale in those counties that are have lower percentages. Lower numbers on that scale.
And Representative Smith-Warner, I think a lot of that is accurate. And you can, of course, imagine if you had a reset at sale, but you're resetting to the real market value, which is in an economically depressed area, then you're resetting to a low number anyway, and the assessed value is relatively low.
Right.
So there's not much change there. Yeah, I think that, California has reset at sale, and people have discussed the pros and cons of that, and there's different impacts to areas that may have more commercial property than residential property with that.
Great. Thank you.
I have one more question. I don't know if this is sort of an esoteric issue, how much there is something to it or not. In thinking about not the placement of the bar, but the length of the bar, the difference between assessed value and real market value. Mm-hmm. Some of that, a lot of it has to do with the local economy, of course, and what's going on in the market. To what extent does the county assessor's activity and processes or procedures to keep up, are there places where assessors are less able to keep up with the responsibilities because of staffing or other burdens on the office? And that might account for some of that discrepancy. For example, some of the bars that are a little bit longer appear to be Curry, Douglas, and Morrow. I'm just eyeballing it. I didn't study it carefully.
Chair Nathanson, I can't speak for all the assessors, obviously, and all the counties and their staff, but I have participated in some of the courses with property tax assessment and did hear of assessors saying that there were, you know, there's requirements to assess and value properties at different intervals, and sometimes those counties struggle to meet that. Technology has helped in some of those cases, but when it comes to, like Google Maps, for instance, to help them identify where new properties are built, when it comes to things like personal property for businesses, et cetera, some of those technologies don't help, and having to physically go out on the ground at different intervals have been hampered, or with shorter staff or less but smaller budgets. But I would guess that over this session that we may hear from the Department of Revenue and the assessors to speak more clearly on that.
Thank you.
Yes, just a technical question. What's the significance of the vertical lines, and where, how far down they go to the baseline?
Thank you for asking that. I was thinking that as well.
It's very simple.
Chair Nathanson, the vertical lines are just the all the data that we see in those individual counties. Just the sheer, so like if mm-hmm. if you have a property that's assessed at one, you're going to see the line go all the way up at one. Mm-hmm. If you have a property that's the lowest ratioed valued property is at 0.2, then that line will stop at 0.2 at the bottom. But if there was one that was in a different county assessed at 0.1 of the real market value, that vertical line would go all the way down to 0.1.
I believe that they represent a minimum and a maximum in the county.
Yes.
Right at the top.
Yeah, that's probably a better way of saying that.
This is a great graph. Great graph. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of, I don't know, maybe this will be a tweet or something. If you want to impress your friends and family with how wonky we get in these meetings, this graph will do it. This is wonderful. Thank you. We're just going to distribute this with pride. Look at what we did today.
Okay. Thank you. To get a little bit more nerdy. Here I'm just exposing a little bit more about one county. I have these same graphs for every single county. But the blue, the side that is the blue dots, that is literally the sort of bubble dots of all the properties in the county. In looking at the different counties, I found that it might not be super descriptive because some of the bubbles are laying over each other, so you can't see the full concentration. And so then that's when I did this sort of histogram kind of bar graph that shows where the majority of or properties are hitting in terms of CPR. So the CPR is along the bottom axis, and you can see that there's a decent chunk of properties that are being assessed at a ratio of 0.35 to 0.45. That's the sort of highest point on that histogram. But then there's also another proportion that are around 0.6. And so, you can decide whether that's a problem or it's a lot of variance or not a lot, but that is what the dispersion of the properties in Multnomah look like. And like I said, I had given a presentation on this particular issue, and so we have data for all the counties that look like this. Okay. And just in terms of examples, Rep. Reschke had also asked about, for instance, like a particular property. This doesn't track any particular property over time, but it does tell you what that assessment ratio, the CPR, does to taxes or the revenue that's able to be raised at at the county level. For instance, if you have a rate of 0.022, which isn't actually uncommon, so I looked at the rates around Multnomah and Marion County, and those two rates, 0.017 and 0.022, those are kind of common. And then you had a $500,000 property, you can see the big difference in revenue that's raised, even with the same tax rate. You know, you're looking at a difference of $2,000 on the top end. If the ratio drops from 0.6 to 0.4, the CPR.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have any idea of, generically, how many homes in this scenario would be at that $3,400 tax versus the $6,600? Are there more homes at the $6,600 level or at the $3,400 level?
Representative Smith, I don't know offhand.
Yeah.
But I can say that when I was looking, for instance, around Multnomah County, 0.017 was a certain area. I think it was southeast Portland, and the 0.022. I think it was southwest, but I'd have to look. And so those were different areas. And this histogram would kind of represent the proportion that's sitting on those two ends. So you'd kind of look over on the graph to see like 0.4. Like I said, it's sort of frequent. It looks like we have about the largest number of properties in any sort of category are right there. That's 3.5%, but that's just for one of the values. But I can get more data.
No, don't do that. The reason I asked that question is if we wanted to incentivize Oregonians to have a new conversation on Measure 5 and Measure 50, to me it seems like we ought to know where these $500,000 properties in this example are lying. Are they at the higher end or at the lower end? It's going to be pretty hard to incentivize Oregonians to have a conversation if the vast majority are on the lower end.
Yep.
Versus the higher end. And so I was just curious. One other thing I'd point out, Madam Chair, just very, very briefly, it's really interesting on Measure 5 and Measure 50. Eastern Oregon didn't vote for those. Those weren't supported by Eastern Oregon. As a matter of fact, at the time, many of the Eastern Oregon counties were an adamant no on it because of loss of local control. And if you took Measure 5 and eliminated that in Morrow County would be walking on gold-plated sidewalks right now because of all the industrial wealth, but only a population of 13,500 people. Just an observation.
Thank you.
Just to bring back the sort of concept of that bubble chart and all the dispersion for the different properties, what does it mean? I have this at AV, RMV, the CPR equal to 1, but what it would mean for all of the properties to have the same CPR, that whole bubble chart that was dispersed would look like this. And then there's other counties. So for instance, Washington County, that doesn't look like Multnomah County, but it definitely does have a peak that's higher in terms of the CPR, it's around 0.68, but also the properties kind of all slightly more tight together, so there's less dispersion. So there's this graph is just the question or the idea of a uniform CPR for all properties is the graph on the left. And then something that's not Multnomah County, but slightly more tight in dispersion or properties that are closer together is for instance, Washington County.
We have quite a few slides left. Normally we would end at 9:45. I think at least a few of us can stay at least until 9:50. So could you please pick out the most important information for us to see before we leave?
Sure. Thank you very much.
Let's say we have at least 7 minutes.
Okay. So I only bring these up in the sense that I think you're aware that there are several bills out in this session that deal with property tax, and they're pretty, some of them are similar. Moving the CPR closer together, 0.75 would bring people that have properties above 0.75 down towards 0.75 and moving from the other direction over time. There's some homesteading bills and moving individual properties that are commercial and business off compression.
So we'll see them on a list.
You'll see them. Okay. Tax revenue from property was $6.5 billion imposed. That's without urban renewal. $6.6 billion was extended, and that's without urban renewal. And we had a decrease across the state of compression. I'm going to skip to... I'm going to skip to this graph, which is, since you are interested in the question of equity, this is a current graph of the value of the property in Oregon, which is in the red bar, the assessed value. So, for instance, including the most recent year, residential property accounts for 53% of all the properties in the state. Residential property owners pay for 56.5% of all property taxes in the state. And you can see how that is, those similar numbers are reported for commercial, industrial, and some farm and forest properties. And so, for instance, commercial, industrial, they own 18% of all the value in the state, and they pay 14.8% of the taxes. These are assessed values. As we pointed out, the real market values are sometimes difficult to nail down. And this slide just puts us in perspective towards the other Western states. The graph that was in the map that was in the slide before gave us a relationship between Oregon's tax rates and the rest of the country. It seemed to me that the East, the Midwest, the middle of the country, and the West have very different tax approaches, and so I characterize this as the Western states and Oregon. And so our tax rate sits at the higher end of the tax rates around the West, even though we sit kind of smack dab in the middle in terms of tax rates in the U.S. The East Coast has as much higher taxes than the rest of the country in general, per value property.
It would be interesting to also be able to note which of those states has which other kinds of tax, income tax, sales tax, and so forth?
This is a big component. Some of them don't have sales tax or income tax, estate taxes. So the layers are different in Oregon as well.
Thank you for jumping to these two slides. The last three. Are there other questions?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. So the Oregon compared to the rest of the West is very interesting. Do you have that for business property tax? Or is there a way to do that calculation for business?
I can look at that for you, Representative Morris.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. I really appreciate all the information. Is there any other business before us this morning? Okay. Thank you. We're adjourned.